Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Chenjerai Kumanyika, communications professor at Clemson University in South Carolina. Hi, Chenjerai.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Thanks so much for joining us. A major battle has broken out in the Iraqi city of Ramadi between national security forces and soldiers loyal to the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. The militant Sunni group launched a new offensive this week involving car bombs and suicide attacks. Ramadi is only 70 miles from Baghdad and is key to the U.S.-backed Iraqi war against ISIS. Already more than 100,000 Iraqi civilians have fled the city. Meanwhile, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, who was thought to be gravely injured in an airstrike, just released a recording. In it, he mentions the Saudi war in Yemen and calls on Muslims the world over to join his fight from wherever they are. Well, Chenjerai, just when we thought that Iraq and the U.S. might have been winning the war on ISIS, the group resurges. Is there any realistic victory that can come out of this?
Well, no, I think you're right to actually question how does this incident fit in the larger narrative that ISIS is losing the war on Iraq. I mean, you have this audio which comes out, and this kind of appears to be maybe an effort of ISIS to sort of thumb their nose at the attempt to assassinate al-Baghdadi. You know, he makes no mention of any kind of injuries or really any form of weakness in this audio. Of course, there are those who have questioned how new this audio is. Was this something that was previously recorded before the assassination? And the other big issue is the fact that they've raised the black flag in Ramadi, which is a much more central city than previous cities that ISIS had taken. So the question that they have to ask really is, you know, what does this mean for the larger narrative as we've put out? And the other issue is, what diplomatic options and structural options in terms of the economy, in terms of increasing Sunni representation in the government, are necessary to complement the military interventions?
Here in the United States, Chicago police embroiled in the controversy over torture and abuse at a so-called black site called Homan Square have been rocked by another scandal. A man named Angel Perez became the 13th former inmate to detail his horrific experience to media. Speaking to The Guardian's Spencer Ackerman, Perez described being sodomized by a police officer with what may have been the barrel of a handgun. And in Miami Beach, Florida, a full-blown police-related scandal has erupted over private communications that reveal overtly racist and misogynist email threads among officers. As has been seen in private police communications before, there were racist jokes involving President Obama and others making light of domestic violence. More than 500 trials are being reviewed in which officers involved in the scandal are witnesses. Chenjerai, are we still expected to believe that the problem with police is just that of a few bad apples?
Well, unfortunately, the bad apples framing won't die. But, you know, the recent movements for, you know, accountability in police with relation to our police brutality have kind of seen a victory in Chicago as that city takes important steps to provide reparations for victims of police torture. But when you hear the testimony of people like Angel Perez, it becomes clear that this is really the minimum that is needed. The Miami emails and similar emails in Ferguson and other police departments illustrate deep and systemic problem with the culture of law enforcement. But we also have to think about the economics of law enforcement and the economics of cities and how that interacts with police practices. So I think when we take all these things into consideration, what we really need is a fundamental rethinking of law enforcement in the United States.
And finally, the legendary blues musician B.B. King has passed away. King passed away in his sleep at the age of 89 in Las Vegas yesterday. He was one of the most important blues artists to have ever lived and is credited with popularizing the music form to a wide audience. B.B. King was so prolific that he performed in literally hundreds of concerts a year, well into his 70s. Born Riley B. King to Mississippi sharecroppers on a cotton plantation, he began performing during Jim Crow segregation and went on to be one of the country's most decorated and recognized musicians. In its obituary of him, the New York Times described King's music as, quote, a stinging guitar with a shimmering vibrato, notes that coiled and leapt like an animal, and a voice that groaned and bent with the weight of lust, longing, and lost love. Well, Chenjerai, how do you reflect on B.B. King's legacy today?
Well, I'll probably be reflecting by listening to some B.B. King today and maybe even having a sip of bourbon. But B.B. King was really a primary architect of what we recognize as blues. And this is because partially because he expanded the audience of blues by, you know, blending his particular take, regionally situated take, with a broader cosmopolitan sensibility. And it seems like his work as a DJ informed that. But I mean, if you listen to the nuance and emotion of his guitar on the songs that we all know, The Thrill Is Gone and many other ones, I mean, it's just like impossible not to be moved and to feel complex emotions. B.B. King also was born on a plantation, as you talked about, and came to have tremendous wealth. But I don't think he really illustrates any kind of simple story of meritocracy. His music and performances were really an aesthetic testament to the enduring struggle and complicated race and class politics of the Black American experience.
Well, Chandra, I want to thank you as always for joining us today. And we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.
Chandra Kumanyika is a communications professor at Clemson University in South Carolina.